Good morning. So last time we finished talking about our processor design for Y86 that ran one instruction every clock cycle. And finished talking about that, we had this way of dividing up the processor into pieces, kind of as a way so we could think separately about each piece and for each instruction. And our textbook called these stages because of what we're doing next, which is turning this into a multi-cycle processor that's going to be faster. And we went through the remaining stages. There were a few like tricky cases that came up, and those kind of showed why when I talked about RISC versus CISC, I said, oh, all these stack instructions are really complicated, because it turns out that when we're implementing this in the single cycle design, yeah, we can do it, but it actually added a lot of complexity. And one example of this was with POP. We wanted to be reading from the stack pointer value, but computing a new stack pointer value, which was an exception, where for all the other instructions, we computed an address and read from that computed address. And generally, we look through going through a processor stage by stage, you know, thinking about where do we need boxes, where do two instructions want different things to happen with the components we have, like our register file, data memory, and so on. And when we have boxes, how should they be set for instructions? And that's most of the work you'll end up doing in the final single cycle processor homework assignment for HCL that's due after the break. So then we said, okay, we're going to go on to doing things faster. And we introduced that with this sort of analogy with laundry, that if you're doing laundry, you have usually multiple machines to help you, and you have like a washer and a dryer, and no one has the idea that if I'm doing a load of laundry, I need to put it in the washer, then put it in the dryer, and then fold it all up before I can do another load of laundry. That's not how anyone does laundry, but our processors are kind of doing that because when we have an instruction, we put it through the instruction memory, we put it through the register file to read things, we put it through the ALU, we put it through the data memory to potentially read or write some part of memory, and we also maybe put it through back through the register file. So we do all these things in the instruction, and we know that, well, some of them should already be complete or possible to be complete earlier, so we can move on to the next instruction. But that's not what our single cycle processor does. Our single cycle processor just says, we're going to do one instruction beginning to end, and then move on to the next instruction. And it turns out that we're effectively leaving a lot of components of our processor idle a lot of the time because of this design. And so an idea for improving that is to do this thing called pipelining, where we have this kind of assembly line fashion for running a sequence of instructions that we're going to, when we finish the first step, we're going to move on to the second step for the first instruction. But rather than leaving the component that did the first step idle, we're going to put some other operation there. And what we mentioned is that this is going to improve our throughput, the sort of number of things we get done per unit time. It's not going to improve our latency, the time for one thing to get done. And this means that if we want to think of how pipelining helps our performance, we should not be saying, gosh, I'm running all my instructions fast, each instruction faster, because we're not going to be. We're going to be running each instruction slower. We'll talk about in more detail today. Every instruction is going to be slower. But all the instructions together are going to be faster because we're overlapping them now. Whereas previously, they had no overlap at all. So to apply this pipelining idea for circuits, there is sort of some extra stuff we need to do. And in the sort of laundry example, this came up with, well, you know, we think of, you know, I finished doing using one component and I'm not using it anymore, you know, so I don't need it anymore. But with circuits, that's not entirely true. When I finish reading from the instruction memory isn't reading from memory anymore, but it has an output value, and everything later in the circuit needs that output value. So if we just went on to say, well, we read the first instruction, now let's read the second instruction, we'd have this problem that output value would be changing. And yeah, the instruction memory doesn't need that output value anymore, but the things we're sending those values to sure do need it. So to solve that problem, we're going to add some extra storage to our circuit. So we can store that output value while the instruction memory is now working on producing a different output value. And the storage is going to be registers. And they're going to hold our values, so we have sort of stable inputs to each step. And, you know, because of the way our registers work, you know, they're going to hold that value until we have that rising edge of the clock, in which case we'll advance to the next step. And since we have one clock signal in our processor, everyone's going to advance to the next step all at once. And when we finished up last time, I was mentioning, well, it's kind of not the best thing for our performance that we have to add these registers because, well, they're cheap, but they're not free. If we just add registers everywhere in our processor, it's going to take some time. And we kind of talked about registers as if they were instantaneous, but that's not really physically possible. So they actually require us to sort of account for some amount of time when we set how long our clock cycle is, as we'll see. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so last time when we finished up, we were looking at this idea of register tolerances. So we're going to have some amount of time before that rising edge of the clock where the register won't work unless the input is not changing. That, you know, when the register is reading a value, it can't read a value actually instantaneously. It needs some amount of time to do that. And there's some amount of time after the rising edge of the clock where the register, well, it's read a new value, so it's outputting that new value, but it can't actually change from 1 to 0 instantaneously. There's going to be some in-between time. And we're going to call the sum of these two types of times the register delay. For this class, we're not going to be concerned about how much time is before the clock cycle or after the clock cycle exactly. We're just going to call the whole thing the register delay. And let's think about, now that we know about register delays, how long this, our example of this silly way of multiplying by 3, should take. And we're going to say that our adders here take 50 picoseconds, and each of our registers has a total register delay of 10 picoseconds. So, first question, what is the minimum clock cycle time you can safely set for this circuit? So obviously, I can set the clock cycle to like a second, and it would work. But that would mean, presumably, that this first adder would compute a value and after, you know, something a little more, 50-ish picoseconds, and then we'd be waiting most of a second doing nothing. So we want the minimum time we can set. You can check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what's happening. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks, one person, sorry. Yeah, okay, give it a little more time. Continue my drawing and prep for explaining this. So we have. So who thinks A, 50 picoseconds? Okay. B, 60 picoseconds. Okay. C, 65. D, 70. in E130. Okay, we have a plurality on 60 picoseconds, which is usually not how this question goes for me. So I don't have to, so I'll be very, very briefly explain why it's not the most sort of common confusions, which is 70 picoseconds or 65. So if we think of what happens to our values, we're going to have, in one cycle, we want a value to get from one register to another register, basically. That's how far we're going to go in one cycle. And we have to take into account the register delay. And I mentioned the register delay sort of has a component before the clock cycle, the rising edge of the clock, and after the rising edge of the clock. So let's say I'm going to start at the part before the rising edge of the clock, which I've marked here with a little orange dot. So let's say we have a value that's at that orange dot just before the rising edge of the clock going into that first register there. Then, in order for that value to work, we're going to have to send that value through. It's going to have to go through the adder, and it's going to have to end up in the same spot after one clock cycle. And the time I've marked here with this bit of blue. And what we're measuring here is we're measuring a clock cycle in kind of just a weird way, that I'm measuring from just before the clock cycle based on the register delay to just before the next beginning of the next clock cycle, where we think of the clock cycle beginning at the rising edge. But that's still the same amount of time as if I measure from rising edge to rising edge. So that's the length of our clock cycle, and it includes going through this entire register delay and this entire adder delay, but none of the next register delay. So that's how I get 60 and not 70 or 65. We're going to want to be consistent about that. Yes? So the question is, the part where we store the value before the next addition is not counted in the clock cycle? It is. So that's why when I counted this clock cycle, I said we have to store the value to this register here. And for consistency, I was counting only up until just before we store into the next set of registers. Another way I could have counted the same amount of time, which maybe will make this more intuitive, is I could have said that we start here. I should do this in the correct color. We start here, and we end up going again through the adder, but we consider the time to go through the next set of registers. And I'm doing that because I started after a set of registers. And in that case, we'll end up here, and the amount of time we're measuring is also a clock cycle, just in a different way. But in both cases, I need to be careful to not count the register delay twice, because we can only go through one set of registers in a clock cycle. Does that answer your question? Okay, yes?
So for a clock cycle, we just equate that to accessing one register.
So the question for a clock cycle, we equate that to accessing one register? Because our registers are triggered by a positive edge of a clock, we can set multiple registers in a clock cycle, but we can't use set a register, then set another register in a clock cycle. That requires two clock cycles.
So in the green path where you start after the blue register.
Yeah.
So the ALU that happens before the rising edge and once the rising edge happens, then that's when it's stored into the register.
Question, the ALU happens before the rising edge and once it happens, that's when it's stored? Yes.
Okay.
So we got 60 picoseconds for a clock cycle, which means our throughput is going to be one thing every 60 picoseconds, or about 16 billion operations a second. So this is a lot faster than we started out, where we had one every 100 or so. So yeah, we got from 10 billion a second to 16 billion a second. And one thing you could say is, can we just keep doing this? So here you go. Let's just add some additional registers and divide our adders up into two different stages. And let's say now we have what looks like, we have 10, then 25 picosecond piece, then a 10 picosecond piece for the register delay, and so on. And we could say, let's just keep doing this. And there's going to be two issues we're going to talk about with this. So one is, how much faster does this actually get? And another question is more of a logistical one, is that I'm just kind of assuming I can take an adder and split it in half, store the intermediate values there, and that will work. And we're not going to talk much about how adders work internally, but that's making some big assumptions on how you might build an adder that maybe aren't warranted. And in practice, we're going to find that that strategy probably, we're going to be able to, might be able to do something like that, but it's not going to work out so well. So first question, now that I've split things up, what should the throughput be now? How many things will we do per unit time? Would like some more time? Okay, a little bit more. Okay, so who thinks A? B? C? D? Okay, so we have a plurality for C, which is the answer I agree with. And how do I get that? Well, in a clock cycle, if we think of, again, we have our clock cycle, one way we can measure is from just before the rising edge to just before the next rising edge. So just before a previous rising edge will be, say, there, just before this register, the rising edge will go through it, then we'll get up to here, just before this register, and that is 35 picoseconds. And we could measure that a bunch of different ways. So I could also say, let's get from here to here, just before one register, just before the next, and all of them being 35 picoseconds, so we get one operation every 35 picoseconds. So questions on how I figured that out? Yeah.
This is a more general question. So when we say when the throughput is 1 over 35 picoseconds, and we're doing like one instruction per 35 picoseconds, how does that mean it's faster? It sounds like it just means that we're just doing more stuff in like a short amount of time.
So the question is, why am I saying it's faster? So usually what we care about is the throughput number, and it's more operations per unit time, which is better, faster. And we're going to think about this with like processor instructions. If your program has a billion instructions, you'd like us to run as many instructions as we can in a second to get that billion done as fast as possible. Does that answer your question?
I guess what I'm really asking is, how do we know that it's actually like getting stuff done faster as opposed to just doing more stuff but not necessarily like progressing?
So the question, how do we know it's getting stuff done faster as opposed to doing more stuff? So an assumption I'm making here is that we can provide useful work to do every clock cycle. And we'll see when we're talking about a processor that when that assumption holds true, it'll be faster. When that assumption doesn't hold true, it might be even slower.
Thank you.
Yes. So the question is, the throughput is the same as time between one cycle?
Like the two starts and two finishes?
Time between two finishes? Yes. Yeah. So the throughput, except that usually we give throughput in units of work per time instead of time per work. Okay. So let's talk about how much faster can we get. So if we keep dividing things up and it worked out like this, we'd eventually reach a limit. And that's because, well, our register delay isn't going to change. Right? We have to add those registers. Each of those registers is going to have some amount of efficiency. And eventually, even if we can divide up the other work of the circuit, you know, arbitrarily small, we're going to have these big register delays that are going to be dominating our cycle time. That our cycle time always needs to have time to store the value in the register in order for this to work. So eventually we'll be having these circuits which like do something really trivial, then store a value in a register, and this extra pipelining stages is not going to be worth it. So we'll get this kind of, you know, asymptotic result where the time for every cycle is going to go down, but it's going to kind of asymptotically approach our register delay. And if we think of that in terms of our throughput, we're going to get this sort of asymptotic approaching the maximum rate at which we can update registers. And that means that when we add the first few pipeline stages, we get this great improvement. As we add more and more and more, it's going to be not so great. So questions about this sort of diminishing returns here. So another issue we have, as I mentioned, can we do this? I'm kind of saying we're going to split up this adder in half. And that is making an assumption that the adder is actually built in a way where there's a nice, convenient place you can split it in half. Probably there's a place where you can split up the work of the adder somewhere. But you know, maybe it's not going to end up actually being in half. So let's say we split it up, but we split it up into a 30 picosecond piece and a 20 picosecond piece. Still pretty great job. What's our throughput now going to be? So I have this second adder here. I split it up into two pieces, but instead of being 25 and 25, they're 30 and 20. Just because when I looked at the circuit, I couldn't find a halfway point that I could actually use. Give you time. So anyone want to? So I guess let's talk, give our possible answers. So do A, do 30, one every 30. B, we'll do one every 35. C, one every 40. And D, something else. Okay. So who'd like some more time? Right. Every 35. So our old throughput was one every 35 picoseconds. Still, okay, so let's start here. So who thinks A, it's one every 30 picoseconds. B, one every 35 picoseconds. I didn't actually change enough of the circuit to change the cycle time. Okay, a few people. C, one every 40 picoseconds. And D, something else. Maybe it's worse than any of the numbers I gave. Okay, so we have a plurality for one every 40 picoseconds, and that is the answer I get. So let's talk about that. So one thing you might say for one every 35 is you might say, oh, before, when I went to measure the cycle time, I said, I'm going to measure from here to here, and that's a clock cycle. And that's one of the things that has to happen in a clock cycle. But there's a lot of things that have to happen in the clock cycle. And before, it didn't matter because they were all kind of balanced. But here, they aren't. So in addition to being able to do that in the clock cycle, we need to be able to go from here to here. Well, that's the same amount of time. We need to be able to go from here to here, which is actually really fast, but doesn't matter. We still have to handle these slower things. But where the slower things come up for us is that we need to go from here, or we'll be consistent and do before to before. We need to go from here to here in a clock cycle. And that takes 40 picoseconds. And generally, when we figure out our cycle time, we need to look at the worst case, which is sometimes called the critical path in our circuit. And that's going to determine how long our clock cycle needs to be, because yes, we need the things that are shorter to happen, but they can happen if we just make the cycle time longer anyways. But you need to handle that thing which is the slowest thing in our circuit. That still needs to happen every clock cycle. And that's going to determine our cycle time. And this is kind of like with the laundry analogy, like how fast my dryer was determined how fast I could do loads of laundry. And it didn't matter if I made my washer super, super fast. It wasn't going to help. I did do that, so get our answer there. Questions about? So in practice, when we add more pipeline stages, we'll find that we can't split them up evenly, and often we can't even split them up so the sum of the two times of the split parts are even, because we'll have things that previously overlap that no longer do. And so this will be another reason why, you know, there's going to be a limit to how much pipelining we can do and actually get an actual improvement in performance. So now that we've talked a bunch about how sort of pipelining works in this kind of generic circuit case, let's apply it to our processor. And we had these stages. And we're going to use these stages to build a pipeline processor. So we're going to turn these from things where they're just regions of the processor to things where they actually are the order we do things in, and we're going to do one thing in one cycle, the next thing in the next cycle for a particular instruction. But we're first going to make a few edits here. So in our prior version, right, these were regions of the processor, but actually the way things work, all these writes happened at once because they happen at the rising edge of the clock. And the reads kind of happen as things are available. We're going to set this up to be our pipeline. But we're going to make some edits. So one big edit we're going to make is that in the previous stages we talked about, we had this PC update stage. And that was at the end. And that made sense when we're thinking about conceptually how we run an instruction. You think, OK, we're going to do all the work for the instruction, then figure out what we're doing next. And also, it made sense in that in some cases, we needed values, say, from the memory for this PC update. If we're doing a return, we need to read the return address before we can figure out the PC update. In our pipeline, we're going to combine the fetch and the PC update together. And you might say, wait a moment. We don't know what the next instruction is all the time. Like if it's a conditional jump, we haven't done that part yet. If it's a return, we haven't done that part yet. We're going to solve those problems later. But we really want to figure out what the next instruction is in the first stage, because if we don't do that, we can't start the next instruction's first stage until later. So because we need to start a new instruction's first stage every cycle, we need to figure out what the next instruction is to run in one cycle. And for now, we're going to kind of ignore the problem that, yes, that's not always possible. Later on, we're going to talk about how we're going to partially solve that problem. So we end up with these five pipeline stages. So we have this fetch and PC update, our decode, which is misleadingly named by our textbook authors because in the textbook's processor, it only does register reading, execute, memory, and write back. And to give an example of this, I'm going to apply this first to this add processor. which is not going to have a memory stage because there's no use of the data memory. So it's going to keep our slide simpler, but it's going to mean we're going to have 4 stages instead of 5. And first, we have our fetch and PC update region here. We have our decode region, our execute region, and our write back region. And we want to turn this into a pipeline processor. And there's going to be some steps we want to do that. So one thing we're going to eventually do is we're going to add some registers to hold values for example, the decode stage to use while the fetch stage is doing something new. But we have a problem right now. And that's that we kind of have this signal taking a shortcut here. That this signal here goes from fetch to write back. And if we think about how we want our processor to work, we want our signal, our values for write back to come from the previous step, which is execute, not from fetch. And if we just added registers blindly here, we might make a mistake and be writing to a register that's specified by a different instruction than where we got the value from. That would be really bad. You know, we don't want it to, we want to be writing the value where the instruction that specified that value sped, not where some other instruction is trying to write later on. So to help us avoid this, I'm going to first redraw this wire here, like so. So I just drew it differently, so it goes through every stage first. And now that I've done that, all our values go from fetch to decode, then decode to execute, then execute to write back. If we think of how our instruction values are passed, they're always passed from one stage to the next. So now that I've done that, now I'm ready to add registers because I want to store values. So one stage can be working on a different thing than the next. Because with this design, they all have to be working on the same thing or else they'll have the wrong inputs. So I'm just going to add a set of registers between every pair of stages for every value that's going between those stages. So that's our processor ready to do pipeline. And I'm going to name these sets of registers so I can refer to them. I'll call the first the fetch decode registers that are between the fetch stage and the decode stage, the next the decode execute stage, and the execute decode execute registers, I should say, then the execute write back registers. So, and then we have this PC register here, and we can think of that as between fetch and fetch. You know, it's between the same stage because it's going between two, deliberately between two instructions. It's one instruction telling what the next instruction what to do, whereas, say, our fetch decode is one instruction telling what the same instruction what to do, but in the next stage. So if we think of how this works, we'll go through an example. Let's say we're running add R8, R9, then add R10, R11. And that's our program. We have two instructions. How is this going to work? So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to end up reading from, we're going to have the address of R1, of instruction 1, being sent to the instruction memory. And we're going to get out from the instruction memory the add or 8 or 9 machine code. And from that, we're going to extract R8 and R9. We're also going to be computing the address of the next instruction to run, because remember, we merged fetch and PC update, and this was because we don't want it to be the case that we don't execute that add or 10 or 11 until we're all done. If we did that, why would we do pipelining? We just made our processor slower. So we're going to have the address of instruction 2 sitting on the input to the PC, while our 8 and 9 are sitting on the input for those fetch decode registers, because that's what we want the decode stage to do in the next cycle. So questions about what's happening in this first cycle of execution? So then we move on to the next cycle, and we're going to have the address of instruction 2 now sitting on the input to the instruction memory, and therefore we're going to have the machine code of it coming out, and we're going to have the value 10 and 11, the two register numbers from the instruction, sitting on the input to those fetch decode registers. And also, we're going to end up computing the address of whatever instruction 3 is for a layer cycle. In the meanwhile, our 8 and 9 have now gone through the fetch decode registers. So into the register file, we're passing 8 and 9, and we're also passing the value 9 for later for the write back stage. And our register file is going to read the actual values of 8 and 9. So let's say, for example, they happen to be 800 and 900 equals 8, 9. They're going to be sitting on the inputs to the decode execute register along with that 9. So we have two instructions being executed at the same time. So we just read the registers for our first instruction, and behind that in the pipeline, we read the instruction and figured out the fields in it in the second instruction. And we have this general pattern that sort of, we have this train of instructions. The ones later in the pipeline are the ones from earlier in the program. Questions about what's happening so far? Yes?
If you need a source register for the output, why does including a register for the fetch decode make it faster?
If we need a source register for the output?
For register output, right? You need a source register, so some values there, 8 and 9. Why does adding a register there make it any faster?
Why does adding a register here make it faster? So the question is, why is this faster? And the reason it's faster is now we read these register values at the same time as we read the second instruction. So our speed up came from overlapping these two instructions where previously they were not. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So earlier we were able to do this instruction in just one bicycle.
Yes. So your question is, don't instructions now take a lot more clock cycles? Absolutely. The reason why this is okay is that how long clock cycles are is based on how long that critical path was. And our critical path is now going to be much shorter. So even though we have more clock cycles, our clock cycles are going to be much shorter. So the question is, just like the washer and dryer scenario, our first instruction takes the same amount of time, it's just...
As previously?
Yeah, so it actually takes more time than previously, because we added these registers, and also because it's going to churn out that probably our instruction memory and our register file aren't the same speed, and we have to set our clock cycle for the slowest one, but even with that, our throughput's still going to be higher. Yes? Question, why are there three registers in the decode execute part? So here, this first register contains the index of where we want to write the result of this add to. And the other two contains the values we want to add together. So we can't derive the index of the register to write from the values we want to add together, so we need another value. And we definitely need the place to store the result eventually, or else, you know, we can't do that later on. Does that answer your question?
I have another question.
Yeah. The question is, what more registers take more memory? So these registers aren't part of our memories, but they indeed do take space on the processor. They are not free. So we're going to do it because the benefit of having more overlap in the instructions is going to be worth all the extra cost in terms of clock cycle length and power and the size of our processor and so on. Other questions? Yeah.
In the normal case, once you've gotten the register output, why can't you start a new instruction? Right? So normally, once you go from source A to source B and then out to the output B, why can't you start a new instruction there when you have the value you need?
So the question is, why can't, if I didn't have this register here?
Before we added the new register.
Yeah, so the question is, why couldn't we do this before we added the new registers? So before we added the new registers, we'd have this problem that we'd be telling the register file 8, and then we start telling it 10. And the register file, probably it's going to end up outputting the value for R8 at some point, but then it's going to start changing that to the value for R10. And we don't have a good way of making sure things are in sync, so we only see the value for R8 instead of R10 unless we add these registers to do that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is about the timing. So after the first rising edge, where we're in this picture here, where these orange registers have been updated, yes. So after the second rising edge, these green registers will be updated, then these teal registers, and then we'll finally, at the next rising edge, do the register file write. Yes.
So it takes, in this case, 4 clock cycles to do 1 instruction.
So in this case, it takes 4 clock cycles to do 1 instruction? Yes. But notably, in those 4 clock cycles, we also do 3/4 of the next instruction and half of the following instruction and so on. Other questions? Okay, and we can keep moving on here. So then we get to a point where we have our 10 and 11, I should use the consistent color, 10 and 11 being red, so we get R10's value and R11's value. In the meantime, we're going to be taking the first instructions 800 and 900, adding them together to get 1700, and passing through the register number 9. And so we'll have this another case where now, in the next stage, our first instruction is adding its values, while our second instruction is doing its register read, and our third instruction is doing its instruction read. And our instructions are going to keep following behind in that kind of manner. So, and following this, our first instruction will actually write its result of 1700 in my example here, while our second instruction is adding two values together, and so on. And so we can get a sort of chart of what this looks like here. Here I'm showing sort of the output of all our pipeline registers in each cycle. So initially, our PC contains address 0, the address of this add R8 or 9, presumably. And then in the next cycle, we're sending to the decode stage 8 and 9, and we're fetching not from address 0, from address 2. Then in the following cycle, we're fetching from address 4. We've advanced another instruction. We're reading the registers for the second instruction. So we have our 10 and 11, the indexes for that. We have the values to add for the first instruction and the place to put it eventually. And then in the following cycle, we read the registers for the third instruction while adding the registers for the second instruction while storing the registers for the first instruction, and so on. And we can see that each instruction goes one stage at a time through this pipeline. And the instructions, when we have this pipeline completely full, we end up having 4 of them happening at the same time. And that's where our speed up is coming from. Some questions about sort of our overall timing here. So let's think about how fast this is. And I mentioned this idea of critical paths. That in order for us to have our computer cycle time, we need to have enough time in the cycle for every path from something that needs to do a state update to something else that needs to do a state update. Because these are all triggered by our single rising clock edge, and we want the slowest path of all of these. And in our clock circuits, we're going to have to choose one clock cycle length. Yes, it is physically possible to have a processor which has multiple different cycle times for different parts. That is not a design we'll be talking about how to implement. So we're going to be under the assumption that we have to choose one clock cycle length. We're not going to have a mechanism to vary that depending on what instruction is running. That conceptually is possible, but I haven't heard of any general well-known processor doing it on an instruction-by-instruction basis because it's really hard to react that fast. So generally, we're going to have one cycle length that we choose in advance, and that's going to be our clock cycle time. And we could do this calculation without pipelining. So without pipelining, we have our full single cycle processor. We could say, okay, to get from the PC to PC via this adder, that needs 25 picoseconds via for that path. If we're going through the instruction memory, maybe that needs 50 picoseconds. And we could measure how long it is to go through from everything that starts at the rising edge of the clock to everything that starts at the next rising edge. So in this case, going from our program counter all the way to storing a value. And to figure out what our cycle time would be, we would look at all the possible paths and find the maximum. And we can kind of illustrate this with, say, just the add processor here. So let's say that this add 2 is 25 picoseconds, and then we need, let's say, 375 picoseconds to read a value and use it to set up a register file write. Say 500 picoseconds to read a register, do an add, and send it to the register file and set up a write, and so on. And we can measure the times for each of these paths, and we find the maximum. And with the hypothetical numbers I've given here, I'm saying that's 500 picoseconds. We're going to do the same analysis for a pipeline processor. But our paths are not going to go from the PC all the way to something. They're going to go from one of the pipeline registers, which the PC will consider a special case of one, to either the next pipeline register or something that acts on the rising edge of the clock, like the register file write circuitry. So we'll consider all these paths, and we'll take whatever the slowest one is. And in this example, I'm saying the slowest is this case of going through the instruction memory, because my assumption is my instruction memory is slower than my register file and my adder. And so another way we can think about this is that I can say, okay, let's say I have these times for how long each of these components takes. Without pipelining, I need to be able to go through the instruction memory, then through the register file, then through the adder, then back through the register file for write, and that is my slowest path. I also need to do add 2, but that can actually happen overlapping with all this other operation because of how our circuit looks. So it doesn't figure on my critical path for this single cycle version of this processor. Now with pipelining though, you have to take into account those pipeline registers. So that was the no pipelining version. So with pipelining, I have to be able to do this in one cycle, and I have to be able to do this in one cycle, or this in one cycle, and this in one cycle, or the other path in one cycle. And I just find how long each of those takes, and that's going to be my cycle time, except I also need to take into account I have pipeline registers on these, so I'm going to have to add the delay for those pipeline registers. So our time for a cycle is going to be 200 picoseconds plus our register delay time. In this example, why 200 picoseconds? Because we're going to depend on this slowest component here, which is the instruction memory. That needs to happen every cycle. We need to read from the PC, put it in the instruction memory, and send it to another register. So we're going to have 200 picoseconds plus however long our pipeline registers take. So this means that this processor runs one instruction every 200 plus a little extra picoseconds. That's pretty good compared to one every 550 picoseconds. But if we think of how long it takes for the instruction to go from start to finish, it's actually over 800 picoseconds. But we're probably going to be okay with that because it sure is a lot better to run a program with a million instructions in around 200 picoseconds times a million than around 500 picoseconds times a million. units of time. So questions? This is her. Okay, so let's do electricize. So let's say the first instruction here just stored its result in RBX. What did instruction 3 just do? Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A just did fetch, B, C, D, E? Okay, we have a big plurality for B, and that's what I get. So way I can think about that is that we just did instruction 1 here, which means instruction 2 is just behind it in the previous stage, so it just completed the execute. Instruction 3 must have just completed the register read. Okay, so let's do second exercise. So here I have our processor, we said that we get 200 picoseconds plus register delay. Let's say I combine the add and register file read together. So the modification I'm going to make is I'm going to just get rid of these pipeline registers and just replace them with normal wires. So I'm going to have one less pipeline stage. My question is, what's our new cycle time after I do that? Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks A, it's the same. B, okay, C, D, E, or what should be F. Okay, so let's go through. We have a plurality for B. That's the answer I get. So let's talk about what our logic here is, what the logic is here. So we're looking for the longest time we need for a clock cycle. And remember, we talked about we have these things that have to happen in a clock cycle, and we just need to consider all of them. And previously, we looked at all of them. We had, like, going through the add to was one, going through the instruction memory was one, going from the register file to that old set of Python registers was one, and so on. We looked at those. And previously, our longest one was this one that went through the instruction memory and then to the next register. And that was our 200 picoseconds plus the register delay. So with this change to the pipeline registers, what we've done is we've changed the critical paths that involve this add and this register file. So let's think of the paths through that new stage, that new combined stage. So we're going to have, so we have some paths which are not a problem, like this one here, right? That's basically just a register delay. We just send this value, the register index. We also have this path here that goes through the register read and then through the adder. And if we think of how much time that should take about 225 picoseconds. And we also have another instance of that path, which is the same. So we have two 225 picosecond paths, and I should say 225 picoseconds plus a register delay, because they have to come from a register and go into a register. And I believe I can't find any longer paths that we've added. We've only modified that stage. So that's what I get as our new cycle time. It has to handle what is now our longest stage, which is this new combined one, which is now 225 picoseconds. Note that it didn't matter that what the prior longest stage was, except that we got longer than it. That's the only part that mattered. We didn't like have to add something to the 200 because we weren't modifying that stage. So now a different stage that determines our cycle time. So questions about how I figured that out? Okay. So next we're going to talk about implementing pipelining in ACRS. And to do this, we need pipeline registers. And there's a naming convention the book uses that I would encourage you to use, but we're not going to actually check. But I'm going to use on the slide, so I'm going to talk about it. And that's for these pipeline registers here. I'm going to call this set of registers here. We're going to declare it in HTLRS as register F, lowercase f, capital D, and a set of registers, which means the inputs are going to be lowercase f something, and the outputs are going to be uppercase D something. And for the next set of registers, we're going to call this, from decode to execute, register D, lowercase D, capital E. And the general pattern here is that lowercase is always an input, and it's always named after the stage it's coming from. So F for fetch. Uppercase is always an output, and it's always named after the stage it's going to. So D for decode. And this means that if we follow this convention, all the HCL code we write for each pipeline stage is going to be dealing with values that are prefixed with the stage letter. So all their stuff for decode will either be using values that start with a D coming from pipeline registers, or values for related to specifically the register file and other things we're definitely doing specifically in decode. So this is the convention we're going to follow, and that means that we can look at the first letter of the name to figure out what stage this value is for, regardless of whether it's a register input or a register output. So questions on that naming convention? Okay, so with that in mind, let's write out our add processor with pipeline. I'm going to just show parts of it. So in our fetch stage, we're going to do our register read, sorry, our instruction memory read the same way we did it in the single cycle processor. But then we're going to have to not take the values directly from the instruction memory in the next stage. We're going to have to pass them to the pipeline registers. So I'm going to declare a set of pipeline registers here to store those two register indices. I've set the default values to be regnon. And I did that so when our processor starts up, we don't do anything based on the default values. So the default values are going to this, you know, don't do anything on startup. That's why I have these default values. So I deliberately chose default values that aren't going to do something in the first step until before we've read any instructions. But when we read the first instruction, we're going to shove its register indices into these two registers. So I'm going to use the inputs, which start with lowercase f. And then I'm going to get the outputs from them into these capital D values. And that's going to happen in the next cycle, because this represents, we have our FRA as input going into capital DRA as output. So our instruction is going to go through the pipeline in those steps where there's going to be one cycle in between when we have it on FRA and when we have the same value on capital DRA. Rising under the clock to make that happen. And you can see in our decode logic here, I'm using our register file built-in inputs, just like we did in the single cycle processor, but rather than, say, adding those values directly, I'm going to put them in a pipeline register because we know the add's supposed to happen in a different stage. So I send to the register file the register index we want to read, and then I get the value out, and I don't add it right away. I'm putting it in another set of pipeline registers because we do the add in a different cycle. So then I have a set of pipeline registers here going from decode to execute, which include our register index. Note that I just passed that register index through, so I had to write some HCL code to represent that wire that just goes through the stage and does nothing. Still needs to have code for it to represent going from one register to the next. And I also have two registers to represent our values we read from the register file. Some questions about the sort of code I have written here. And one way of maybe thinking about this more systematically is that if we compare our unpipeline code and our pipeline code, the big difference is that when we're computing a value like in fetch, we're not going to compute it in just, you know, some wire we're going to use elsewhere. If it has to be used in another stage, we're going to put it in a pipeline register. And similarly, when we're using a value in something like decode, we're not just going to get it directly from another stage. If value comes from another stage, we're always going to get it through a pipeline register. So we just have to make sure we aren't trying to pass values directly from fetch to decode. We can't do that. It has to go through a register because there's a delay in time that the register needs to make happen. Questions about our strategy for HCL writing. So this is sort of the high level strategy. So, and what you're going to do in the first lab after break is do this for some very simple instructions with a two-stage pipeline. Yes?
In the actual HCL, when you implement it this way, are you actually going to like for all the instructions that follow the first instruction, would you actually like code them in, or would that like automatically work?
Question is, for all the instructions that follow the first instruction, do I have to code something extra? No, because if we think of how this is going to work, is that this code can execute independently of this code because they actually are using different values. Right, so because we've set these registers up, we are handling having two instructions happening at the same time because the values for DRB in cycle 2 are going to be the ones that we stored previously. But the values for i10 bytes are going to be based on what we set in the PC to now, which could be for a different instruction. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and so does the HTL kind of know if, like, that you set it up that way?
The question, does the HTL know you set it up that way? So the thing that it knows is it knows how registers work. And this giving us that kind of going through the pipeline stage by stage and letting us have multiple things, it's just a consequence of having registers that store a value that was set in a previous cycle. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and so does it just handle what it needs for one cycle, and then it knows it can put things in for the next one?
The question is, does HTL handle what it needs for one cycle, then it knows they put things in for the next cycle? Yeah, so you've seen this in your single cycle processor. It does what it needs for one cycle, and then that sets things up, some things up for the next cycle. But the only things you've seen set up so far are the condition codes and the PC. Here, it's one of the things we're setting up are these pipeline registers, but it's the same mechanism to set them up. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. So in our last 10 minutes, let's talk about what this is going to look like when we do the whole processor. And we're not going to show all the code because, well, that's part of the assignment, and also it's a lot. So we can take our stages of this processor. So I've kind of highlighted them here. And just like with the add processor, we want to fix some things where values are going from one stage, not to the next stage, but skipping some stages. And we have that happening here, that for a write back, we're sending values directly from the instruction memory. That's fine when we're doing things in a single cycle, but we want to make sure that those values stay together with the things that are supposed to be written to those registers. So to solve that, we're going to rewire that so it goes from fetch to decode to execute to memory to write back, so they're all kept together along with, you know, what value we're going to write to those registers. I've also made another change here that you don't have to make, but is going to make some things we're going to do later a lot easier. And that change is I have elected that in the decode stage, even though I don't write registers, I'm going to compute the index of the register we write to. And this is going to make things a lot easier later because it's going to turn out we're going to want to figure out where is this instruction going to write later on. For a bunch of reasons, having that information computed early is going to be helpful. So that's what we're going to do, and that's what our textbook does. So I compute where we're going to write, and I just pass that through along with sort of either the values we're going to write or the things we're going to use to compute those values we're going to write. Make sure everything for one instruction is together. So now that they've done this, I have my values going from one stage to the next. I just add pipeline registers between all my sets of stages. And one thing I haven't dealt with here that, yes, we're going to have to deal with is the signal here for return. We're going to have to talk about that as a very special case later on. But other than that, all our values for instructions go from one instruction to the next, to the next, to the next, and so on. And through these sets of registers sort of I've drawn here. Okay, so questions about the sort of general organization of our pipeline processor. So something I haven't shown here, so I've shown sort of how the data moves, but I haven't shown the control logic. And there's something we need to do for the control logic that we should talk about. So let's think of the example of doing a read or write from memory. So one of the things our data memory needs is that read enable and write enable signal. And in our single cycle processor, we get the I code from the instruction memory, and we either read it, well, we decide that's either a memory read, memory write, or neither. We have some logic for that. But if we do that for our pipeline processor, the I code that's coming out of the instruction memory is not the one for the instruction that we're actually having the memory stage. Right? That instruction we fetched several cycles ago. So what we actually want to happen is you want to get this I code from a pipeline register that And that pipeline register, well, because it's the memory stage, right, we're in memory here, it needs to happen past, because we only pass from one stage to the next, from the execute stage, which then needs to have gotten it from the decode stage, which then could have gotten it from the instruction memory. So we're going to have passed this iCode value through all the stages to make sure it's from the correct instruction. So rather than, say, getting this iCode from the instruction memory and setting it in our HCL code, we're going to have a whole bunch of registers that it gets passed through in order to make sure it stays with the instruction as it goes through the pipeline. Because it's going to take several stages to get there, we need to store it several times, once for each of those stages it takes. We have to make sure we actually use the correct iCode. And this is going to come up generally with all our control signals. So questions about sort of why I needed to add this extra set of registers here for our control signals. Yeah?
Sorry, do you mind repeating the problem again?
So the problem is that before we added these registers, this iCode here, if we think of our pipeline, this is for, let's say, instruction 4. And this is for instruction 1. If we think of our pipeline, we have our fetch has instruction 1, then we have our register file has instruction 2 in decode, then we have our ALU has instruction 3, I have this the opposite way around. Our fetch has instruction 4, which came after instruction 3, which is in decode, which came after instruction 2, which is in write back, and instruction 1's in memory. So we'd be several instructions behind. That value there from the instruction memory would be several instructions behind. So to fix that, we're going to get it from a register, which will have come into their register that will have been sent as the instruction went through the pipeline. So ultimately, it came from the instruction memory, but not right now. It came from the instruction memory several cycles ago. Yes? Would I define this iCode here in the same register block as everything else? Generally, yes. I just, for clarity, for space on the slide, I didn't do that, but we'd also have, like, RA and so on, or whatever else we're passing, whatever we decide to pass from fetch to code. Other questions? Yeah. So the question, would we also have to do the same thing with our zero flag and our sign flag? So the general rule I would give is that we always want to be reading from the prior stage's outputs and sending to the inputs to the next stage, except for things that are deliberate sharing for instruction, between instructions. And our condition codes are an example of that. We want the condition codes to come from a different instruction. Right? So we need to take that into account. And we want like our register values to come from a different instruction. So those are cases where we're not going to use values necessarily from pipeline registers. We're going to have to think about how they come from, because we want to get values from different instructions. We just need to make sure that that still works right. And our solution for the condition codes is going to be that we're always going to change them and execute and read them and execute, so we don't have to worry about them being out of sync. But we aren't going to put the condition codes in a pipeline register, because they're not something we pass from one instruction. They're not something we pass along with the instruction, like the iCode. They're something we're passing from one instruction to a different instruction. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
How is the register for read and write enabled, like, placed in the whole process of graph?
The question is, where on this picture is that? So I didn't show any of the control logic, but if we remember, we said we had this thing which, like, computed the sort of, which, like, used the iCode to, like, compute the inputs to all these things here, right? So that the way that's going to have to work is that we're going to have to extract the iCode here and then use that to have one computation of all these things for each clock cycle for each stage. So each stage is going to have its own logic that takes the I code or some other signal from a prior stage and figures out how to set all the muxes based on that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so there are two sets of registers, one is for the data flow and another is for the logic flow.
Question, there are two sets of registers, one for the data flow, one for the logic flow. So in your HCL code, they'll probably all be in the same register bank, but there are registers I haven't drawn, yes, that contain control values, like the I codes we need to make all these muxes work correctly or to set the write enable, read enable signals here. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's all I have for today. So next time we'll review this a little bit, and then we're going to talk about fixing some cases where, if you look carefully, we don't compute the right values.